And we're live. Hello, everyone. My name is Marco Dini Santos, and this is the Weird Podcast. Today with me, I have the author, Katie Girard. As many of you may know, she's one of my favorite authors of all time, so I'm a bit geeking out, fanning out, but trying to control it. Katie, and I'm going to read now. Katie is the author of Seth, the Gate is Open, and Odin's Gateways. By the way, the Gate is Open is one of my favorite books ever. She's a witch, an hypnotherapist, a psychology student, a coach. And that's who she is. And I'm very happy and to welcome here today, Katie Girard. Hello, Katie.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, I mean, it's my pleasure. So let's kick this off by letting our viewers know who you are. I mean, I made this little introduction, but I mean, this isn't like the whole deal with you, right? Who are you, and how did you start with your relationship with the Norse mythology and the Norse gods and everything and magic?
So, probably quite a long story. I'll try and keep it short. I basically, like lots of people when I was a teenager, started getting very interested in witchcraft and mind, body, spirit stuff and paganism and things. And I went to a university that had a pagan society. And this university...
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was really, really good. And this university was in Wales, and we obviously did a lot with lots of different gods, the Egyptian and the Welsh gods and the Morrigan, things like that. And I really wanted to kind of know more about my home. So I'm from a place called Essex, is where I grew up, and the deities that we have are Anglo-Saxon. I started looking into some of the Anglo-Saxon gods, but really sort of hit upon the Norse. And one of the people there in the pagan society was from Iceland and introduced me to the runes. And then basically my journey with the Norse gods really started there. And I saw one line in a book that talked about Seith being the basically the female version of Gaudra. And I decided, oh, that's what I want to do. But of course, there just wasn't really a lot of information about it back in those days.
And somehow I'm getting some chills right now. And how did it go? How did that journey go? I mean,
So there was one book, Sideways by Jan Fries, and I tried to get hold of that book, and it was out of print for a while. We even sort of called and like left messages on Mog Morgan's voicemail to say, could you tell us when this will be back in print? Yes, because obviously you had emails, but it wasn't quite the same in those days.
So we're talking about what, 1990 something?
It would have been 97, maybe 98. So, but probably 97 back then. So, and then a little bit later, Jenny Blaine's book came out, and there was a thesis that I found a few years later, but I only found that through Jenny Blaine's book. And so right back in the 90s, I said, oh, there's no book on this. Why is there no decent book on this? Oh, maybe I'll write one, in that egotistical way that only teenagers can do. I'm just going to write a book on this.
No, I mean, it's not egotistical at all. I mean, we wouldn't be here if you hadn't had that egotistical thought, right? So, yeah. So you wrote the book, and it kind of blew up. How was it? How was the adoption?
So it took years. So it took lots of hours sitting in the British Library, looking at old folklore journals and things, falling asleep in there sometimes. It took lots and lots of practical work as well. So lots of really kind of getting people together, making them do trance work with me. And awesome. Yeah, it was 10 years.
We'll get to that. We'll get to the trance work talk, because that's something that I'm very interested in. But yeah, go on, please.
So yeah, it took 10 years, and in fact more than 10 years from that point. So it got to the point, so I'd promised it to my friend as a publisher for years and years and years, and then I immediately kind of arrived at them and went, oh, I did a course on runes, and the notes for the course are basically a book. So do you want to publish this book? And Sarita from Avalonia was like, yes, but where is this Seath book? So Odin's Gateway sort of just appeared first. Oh, and then yeah. I was sort of, you know, really focused to, I must actually finish this book now, because it's gone on for years.
Yeah, it's quite funny. I would like to call the attention of my editor right now. So if he's listening to this, see, I'm not the only one. So Alexander, you know, good books take time. I wish, I mean, but the fact is that I am writing a book on runes, and based on the notes from my courses, so as well, which is kind of funny. Actually, The Gate is Open had a lot to do with the way I see Seath, I also started by reading Jenny Blind, of course, and the whole swaying thing really, really got into me. And I was like, okay, this might be a different way to get into trance. And my relationship with the gods and with the whole archetypes of the Norse mythology started gaining another dimension when I read her, and when I read you as well. For me, as a reader, and this is the part where I'm finding out, for me as a reader, I really feel that your approach to Seath is a more contemporary one, a more open one than most of the authors out there, and this really connects to me, because I'm pro operative runology, if you want to call it that. You know, like it only makes sense for me if it can change your life and it can help you become a better person and improve your reality. But this is often limited by many conventions of how it was, you know, and how it should be, and what is Neo and what is old and what are the old ways, and if it, and the idea that if it isn't done like in the old ways, it isn't valid. What do you have to say about this?
Sorry, I lost you for pretty much okay. all of that question. I'm sorry.
but my question was about doing the thing. There's this current that says if things in magic, in Sith, in runes mm-hmm. aren't done like in the old ways, they're not valid, mm-hmm. right? And what do you think about this? What's your take on it?
So, again, this could be a very long answer. So,
we have time.
So the thing is that we aren't living in old times, and we can learn a lot from what has happened. We can learn a lot from the way things were done, but we know things that they didn't, we do things that they didn't, we live very different lives. And I just think that religion and spirituality is such a personal thing, it's such an important thing within your life, that it should be something that is supported and part of everything else. So, I mean, just look at Wicca. So Wicca 20 years ago, when I first started getting involved with it, suited the time, but there's so much now that is really, really dated. And
we all started there, right?
Wicca is all about polarity. We have a completely different understanding now of polarity and gender than we did then. So by trying to do things in exactly the same way, using exactly the same ideas, we do ourselves and the traditions a complete injustice. And it's the same with the Norse stuff. You know, we have different laws, we have different expectations. We don't in the UK live in a place where we have to go and live in our longhouses and hibernate for 3 months, 6 months of the year. So we have to do things in a way that works for us.
Yeah, that would be fun to hibernate for 3 or 4 months.
But that is, I mean, a lot of the Norse traditions are based around the fact that everything was frozen. And if you think about the whole visitor thing and the Havamal and all mm-hmm. of the laws and things, or they're not really laws, but all of the things that Odin said, they're based on a community that lived in lived lots of winter. So all of that, make sure that you look after visitors, make them feel welcome, is because if a visitor came, they may have to stay for a month. It's just it's a very different world. Yeah, I don't need to do that. If somebody comes around my house, they're actually fine to just stay a night, or for like a couple of hours, I'll give them a cup of tea and send them off on their
way.
That's
what's required from you now.
yeah. But if I was trying to live by the old ways, then I'd move them in, give them the best place by the fire, lots of food. Probably don't need to do that.
Yeah. And we were talking about, you mentioned, a bit of trance work, and also mentioned Wicca, of course. And it's funny how the paths are taken very similar all over the world, I guess. I mean, here we, and I'm looking at my friends and we do have a friend in common, which is André Henriques, that I had the pleasure to interview here a couple of months ago. And we both started out with Wicca as well. Until we found our tradition that resonates more with us. And I mean, I don't, to for what I can think of, I don't have any Norse ancestry, but it does resonate with me. So, and I know that there is this current that says that if you don't have any Norse ancestry, you cannot worship the Norse god, the North gods, or you cannot recognize the North gods within you if you don't want to call it worship. As I like to I don't like to call it worship. I just call it recognizing them inside me and working with their archetypes. What do you think about this? About people who don't, people who think that if you don't have ancestry connected to the Norse, you cannot worship the Norse gods.
So, I mean, I think we have to really change our view of what ancestry is. So I've been doing a ridiculous amount of work at the moment with the ancestors. And to just consider the ancestors as being genetic really does them a massive disservice. My ancestors are the people that built my town. My ancestors are the people that were originated, that created hypnotherapy. People like Mesmer, people like Freud, they're my ancestors. My ancestors are the people that taught me witchcraft, that taught me paganism. My ancestors are those who fought for my civil rights. So ancestors are not, for me, just genetic anyway. But when you're looking at, do I have Scandinavian blood, well then how far are you going to take that? Because different Norse gods were worshipped in different places of Scandinavia. It's a huge place. Are we talking about the Orkney Islands? Are we talking about Scotland? Are we talking about York? If you come from York, do you now have Norse ancestors? They were a group of people.
Even Iceland.
Iceland, yeah, Ireland. So, I mean, I think we really need to move beyond that. And it's really difficult because obviously I also believe that if you don't have direct ancestry with Native American people, you shouldn't use Native American stuff. So, these two things kind of almost contradict each other. Yeah. But I don't really feel that the Norse society has been discriminated against and oppressed. So therefore, whilst cultural appropriation is an important thing for all cultures. And personally, I feel when I see white supremacists and racists using my gods and my symbols, it just burns my soul. Yeah. It's horrible, horrible. But it's that whole, I guess, there's a difference between taking things out of context and using things in the way that they feel. But then again, from the beginning, we say we can't do things exactly as the Norse did. So it's such a big conversation. But the most important thing is, when you call to those gods, do they listen? Do they come to you? And actually, the Norse gods really, in my experience, do not care. They don't care where you're from. They don't care what language you're speaking. They don't care what hair color, skin color you have. And I really do think that ancestry is much, much better. Bigger Rider, than simply
brother than
and we need to think of it like that, because we have a worldwide community now. And the Vikings traveled a very, very long way. They did go down to Africa, yeah, to the Middle East.
They were here in Portugal as well.
So how do we, you know...
They conquered Sintra, by the way. They conquered Sintra 50 years before Dom Afonso Henriques, which was our first king. Maybe they have this deep connection with Sintra, and that's the place where I teach. Have you ever been to Sintra?
No, I'm a really bad traveler. So
have you ever been to Portugal?
No, I haven't even been to Portugal at all.
Okay. So you're invited to come to Portugal and to Sintra and to stay at my place a couple of nights, you know, in your family. Like, you don't have to stay for a month or two.
You can do a few days.
I can offer you a cup of tea.
You can give me the best place by the fire.
By the fire. Actually, it's right behind me, the fire.
There we go.
You're absolutely invited to come to Portugal and to. I'm sure Andrea already did that invitation, but I'm just extending it. Continuing with our conversation, and we talked a bit about trance, and. In one of the interviews that I also had the pleasure to do here was with Diana Paxson, and we talked a lot about trance because it's also a subject that I care a lot about, and she was making this connection between Umbanda and the trance work that's done in Umbanda and the trance work that is done in Sith circles, and how was your journey? How did you discover your version? Because I do believe that everybody has their own version of trance work. How did you encounter that your version of your trance work, and how did it came to be?
So again, a very long answer. So So one of the first things I did when I wanted to find out about Seath was I looked for other people that were doing it. And a friend of mine actually printed off the webpage of Hrafna, which is Diana Paxson's group. So where they were talking about trance and showing how you could go into a trance state. We obviously looked at trance in that way. But as a, you know, as a Wiccan, I have experience with trance in different ways within the circle. But I think this is this may be something that's not spoken about very often, but I feel I need to kind of recognize it within myself, is that as somebody who is neurodiverse and who experienced some developmental trauma, I think that my ability to go into trance and to really use it well and to show and help others go into trance is due to the ease that I have moved in and out of dissociative states from childhood, basically. So it's something we don't really talk about that much, and I really didn't consider at all until I started doing hypnotherapy work and started training. I'm a trauma professional, I'm a trauma practitioner. I work with trauma. And it was only when I started learning this and the psychology. And
that is very interesting. I never thought of it that way, but it makes a lot of sense even to me.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, please do keep on. It's starting to make a lot of sense to me now. You realized this when you started working with it, when you started working with trauma?
Yeah. So when I started learning psychology and trauma and sort of looking at things like personality disorders and neurodiversity and was doing some training in these areas, I just sort of realized that actually, you know, we always talk about witchcraft and paganism as being a healing path and that it attracts people who maybe are looking for that level of almost attachment and connection. People will refer to their magical groups as their chosen families. So I obviously can't talk for everybody, but I know from myself, really making that connection that trance work and the ability to, you know, work with possession, to work with trance, to work with altered states, with journeying, almost even that hypervigilance of psychism, you know, being what I called being psychic for many years is linked with that hypervigilance, that ability to see what else is there rather than just the things that neurotypical people might be paying attention to. So yeah, I feel that it's important for me to acknowledge that and to say that my journey with trance is bigger than simply turning up and someone teaching me how to be possessed by a deity.
No, that's really interesting. It kind of makes a lot of sense to me, and I would really like to. Are you writing something about it? Are you? Will we see a book on it? Maybe.
So I mean, I've been promising a book on running groups and developing people spiritually. So spiritual leadership, I guess that's what I've called the Treadwell course I'm doing at the moment. So I've promised this book for again about 10 years, but
I wonder, never those notes from the Treadwell course might turn into something, right?
yeah, but it's so much information, and every month it seems over the last couple of years I've learned something else. And it's again like the Seath book where it will never be finished because it's so important. This work is always being done. I'm always learning more things. So it's not quite ready yet, but it will be maybe in a few years, maybe. Oh, no. But I think I might talk about some of this within it, and also around, I've looked quite a lot at attachment and the concept of secure attachment and how. So I'm doing my master's thesis at the moment, and I'm looking at the way that we as pagans attach to deities and how as polytheists, some of us, me included, will choose to work very, very closely with one deity, even though I have the whole pantheon and the whole cosmos of all the other pantheons of deities to choose between. I attach very strongly to one deity. So Freya, obviously. Always Freya. And
I have an interesting theory about Freya that I want to run by you to see if you what you think about. But yeah, but yeah, let me just the this is something that we said it was going to happen, like subjects just popping up, and we would have to go back and forth. But it's okay.
Lots of jumping around.
Yeah, but yeah, our brains are wired that way. So
it is
what it is.
Yeah, it's the way it goes. So I'm looking at attachment and. If having a one deity that you work with very closely gives you a different, gives you an ability to have a secure attachment. And I'd like to do some more work after this on magical groups and how people can develop a secure attachment to their magical group when they haven't been able to with anyone else in their life, because your magical group, and in particularly those group leaders, your I use the term high priest X now, because I really am moving away from gender. So your high priest X would be somebody that you would have a very different relationship to anybody else. And this allows you, if you've had attachment trauma in the past, to form maybe your first secure attachment. So lots of, I've gone completely off the topic of Norse.
No. It's completely on topic. It's completely on top of that. That's exactly why we do this talks, and that's exactly why we have these interviews, is to go how was it like the Star Trek guys put it, like to go where no man has gone before, to go boldly where no man has gone, something like that. We were talking about trance, and I one of the things that I think about many times is if there aren't any physical peculiarities between someone that or differences between someone that cannot go very easily into trance or someone that does, or a psychic, or someone that is not that much psychic, because I do believe that everybody is a little bit. For instance, let me tell you. I don't think I ever said this in an episode, but I do have ever since I was born, I believe, or at least the doctors think that I have a cyst in my pineal gland. Mm-hmm. And we all know the pineal gland is, right? It's the third vision. So I often think, isn't that the thing that made me see things, or isn't the doctors say that no, that because it would have to be much bigger if it would cause me hallucinations. But I'm not talking about hallucinations, right? Maybe we haven't entered that realm where science meets esoterical work yet, but I do believe that we're gonna get there somewhere, sometime. And I do believe that it's getting closer. What do you think? Do you feel this, that science is moving towards the esotericals in some way?
So I think it kind of skips back and forth a little bit. I do believe that everyone can go into trance, though. So otherwise, I couldn't do my job. So if I didn't believe that everyone had the ability to go into trance, then I couldn't take people's money thinking that, oh, they may be able to, they may not. So, but what I have found is that I work with a lot of people who will say, I don't know if I can, or I can't meditate. So I specialize in neurodiversity as one of my areas. And when you work with people with ADHD, they are very concerned about the fact that their brain is never still. So, and that mine is the same. It's always something going on. Even when I'm talking, there's this here and all these things popping up. So, of course, you can go into trance, but if I try and take you into trance in the same way as I would somebody whose brain concentrates on one thing at a time, then you're not going to be able to do it as quickly or as well. So we can all go into trance. It's just that there are some things that maybe you and I would need to do differently. So, we all can go into trance, and maybe some of the things that we do to go into trance suits us, and maybe that's why we do them. But in terms of science, there are so many things that are coming up. But we, you know, when we talk about esoteric stuff, we're talking a lot about experience. So the only way that we can understand experience is by phenomenological, that long word that I can never say, this kind of research. All we can do is ask people what their experience is and learn from that. So it's very, very difficult. We do have MRI scans now that we didn't in the past. MRI scans are great, but they're not cheap and they're not nice to go through. So the problem with doing MRI work with people is that the whole trauma of going through the MRI machine in the first place is going to put you into an altered state.
It's terrible. It's the humming of the machine. There are machines that now that aren't that scary. That aren't like this huge tunnel that you just go into. But the ones that I did. You lost me?
Yeah, you froze for a second. Sorry.
Okay. I was saying that there are some machines now that aren't the traditional ones that have like the tunnel where you enter. And you stay there. If you have claustrophobia, you're doomed to be in there. Mm-mm. And I have a bit, so I was kind of a bit scared going into one of those. But now there are machines seem like a portal. You know, it reminds me of that series with Richard Dean Anderson, the Stargate. It's almost like a Stargate. What I was asking is that do you think that different ways, we're all actually wired in different ways, right? But people who aren't, people who are neurodiverse, would they have more tendency to adopt an esoterical path or a non-conforming path, spiritually wise? I don't know if the question makes more sense, but
yeah. So I think the question is, is it more likely that people who are neurodivergent would adopt a spiritual path or an alternative spiritual path?
English isn't my.
That's okay. That's okay. I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because I haven't done any research on it. So I would have to answer that question anecdotally. And we do have research to say that people flock to people who are like them. So for me to say, oh yeah, totally, everybody has developmental trauma, everybody has neurodivergence. So of course, is literally only talking about the people who I know who are pagan, who are people who I've chosen to spend time with, who are people I've got to know very well. They are the people I've chosen to attach to connect to associate with. So I couldn't really judge, because I am literally have brought people around me who are like me. So unless there's real proper research and unbiased research, so, you know, then who does it? Is it done by people who are pagan, who aren't pagan? In what context are you finding people who are members of pagan groups? Are they different to people who are studying and doing their own work without getting involved in the wider community? I just think it would be a very hard thing to measure. So yeah. That doesn't
There's
really
so much work to do around this. There's so much work to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And more people are doing it. But, you know, obviously you, as a, you know, as a psychology student, I have one thesis. And then
I'm speaking as a former journalist. Okay, so the mindset is much different from a researcher and a journalist. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's something that I always think of, and I wonder if, you know. Mm. Okay, I was looking at the time, and I usually ask my people I invite to prepare a story. I don't know what story you chose this time. I don't actually know. I usually ask, oh, what story did you choose? This time I let you completely choose by your own. But how much time do you think it's going to take you to tell that story?
I could do it in a couple of minutes, I guess.
I was just because I also wanted to run my Freya thesis through you, because you know I don't have much to, it's a chance that I have to run this thesis. But I think we're gonna go to the story first, and we'll go to talk about Freya, which is also one of my favorite subjects to speak about, and we'll leave that for later. I wonder if the story involves Freya as well.
Sort of, maybe. Complex. So
it isn't about Freya's wedding with the giants.
The
Thor getting into Freya's dress.
Not that one.
I love that one. Okay, I'm gonna give you the stage, and please let us know what the story is. Oh, wait! I just gave myself the stage. So,
my favorite of the Norse myths is, it is very short. It's the story of how Hyd came about. So lots of Seath workers, lots of Volvers took the name Hyd. And basically there was a war between the Aesir and the Vanir, and they swapped hostages, or they took hostages from each other, or they, I guess, swapped people anyway. And the Vanir sent the goddess Gullveig, and so Gullveig sometimes is referred to as a face of Freya, but I don't know, I tend to think of them as different. But so Gullveig
that is my theory, but yeah.
I think of them as different. But Gullveig basically was, I can't remember quite why, I don't think it's ever really given the why, but they tried to burn her. So they put her through the flames three times, and she basically became Hyd. So she became wise, she became somebody that had special skills, witch powers, so she became the the all-knowing Volva Hyde. And I really love this story because I think of it as being, you can go through things in life, you can go through challenging experiences, or even, you know, initiatory experiences, and then how you step out, you may not be Gullvig anymore, but you're Hyde. And who doesn't want to be Hyde, right? So I love Hyde as a story of transformation, basically.
I mean, that's great, because that's precisely the story where I was going with my Freya theory. Mm-mm. But I have more layers to it. Okay? So I'm going to try to convince you. No, I'm not going to try to convince you, but I'm just going to give you my view on it, which is Gullveig. She liked shiny things a lot. Mm-mm. She liked golds a lot, and when she goes, she's used as a sort of a weapon from the Vanir to against the Aesir, right? And we all know that Freya was also a Vanir, so there's this connection. And another connection is that it is said that when Odin tries to burn Gullveig, and she doesn't, because she was mastering Sith, the three Norns come out of her. One for each time he tried to burn her. Right? So he tried to burn her three times. So we have a birth of, we don't know if they're talking about the Norns or the Verdandian school, but they're talking about Norns. And then there's this transformation that turns Gullveig into Hyde. I do believe that it's the beginning of the transformation into what we know as Freya. Not only because of the origin, but because I also believe that there's this the transformation of Freya into Frigg. And why do I say this? Because of I know the name in German of the object, Wichtel, the thing where they do the threading of the destiny.
The spindle.
The spindle. So the spindle is usually passed on from mothers to their children. When we say that Frigga threads and then gives the Wirt to the Norns so that they can create the web of Wirt of Wirt. So I don't never know how to call it, and I called my podcast and I called that my podcast, but yeah, we'll never know how to pronounce this, because I've heard pronounced in so many ways. But yeah, my point is that it's passed from mother to daughter, and so for me it makes sense that Frigga passes on to the Norns as a mother would pass it on to a child. Of course, this also makes sense with the fact that Frigga is seen as the mother archetype. So yeah, it's just a theory, but I like to think of it as the evolution, and it's more or less the same thing that you were saying, that people do have the chance to improve themselves, and they have the chance to become a better person, and even if it's through one story or through my elaborate theory, I do believe that that's the goal, right? And we can we go into circles and we get back to the beginning where I was saying that what matters is that you can improve yourself. Mm. What matters is the operativity of the runes or the operativity of Seath or whatever you want to call it, of magic in the end, right? The ability to change the world around you. Mm-hmm. So just to finish this off, Katie, do you have any courses, workshops you want to announce?
Mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought about that. So I am sort of I've got the Seath course that's starting at Treadwell's on the 4th of May, which is alongside Andre Henriquez. If I've pronounced that right, probably not.
No, but it's okay.
But it's okay. No one's going to judge me.
Yeah, so
that's happening on the 4th of May, and that's a 4-week course. I also run a sort of pagan online moot stroke self-development group stroke meditation group stroke sort of magic group called Bennu's Table, which runs online. It's it's the last Sunday of every month. So we explore a different theory or a different subject each month. And what I've been doing is basically sort of splicing psychology theories with spiritual concepts or with gods or with things from mythology. So last month we worked on polyvagal theory and the concept of nature being healing. So we did a whole like how nature heals via polyvagal theory. And this month we're going to look at the higher self. So that's on the 30th of so that's next Sunday, basically. And we're going to look at the concept of the higher self. So that part of us that knows the bigger picture. And in internal family systems, IFS, that would be called the core self. So we're looking at lots of different things there. And in May, we're looking at the web of weird. So I am in true me style butchering this and looking at the web of weird as a concept of timelining. So in NLP, we have the idea of timelining. Tad James took it a step further and made it timeline therapy. So basically where you look at the things that have happened to you in your life and you use a way of basically identifying these and looking at how to heal from the past and how to change your future based on what happened in the past. So it splices almost perfectly with the web of weird. So I personally look at the web of weird to help me understand both the past and the future. I do lots of work with the web of weird in trauma work. So basically I'm splicing timeline work with the web of weird, but
I believe so. And if people want to join, what can they do?
So it is, the website address is bennustable.org. So that's bennustable.org. And the website will have tickets. So it's free. The tickets are free, but I do also have paid for tickets if people want to contribute. So the paid tickets are voluntary if you prefer to pay, and that just helps me to pay for the website and Zoom and things like that.
Okay, Very cool. And the other course on Treadwell?
Oh, that's so you need to go to Treadwell's London, I think the email address, the website address is, but it's Treadwell's Bookshop. So it's Treadwells. And all the tickets are on there. So if you
Cool.
go to the website, and then I think it's classes and events, and it'll have all the things that are coming up there. And they have lots of really amazing courses on there. So it's worth looking at, even if you're not interested in Seath. And later in the year, I'll run some more courses. But I just ran one on the ancestors, and I'm currently running one on spiritual leadership. But those are both started, so you can't book those.
Okay. So maybe I'll see you on the 4th of May.
Maybe.
Thank you much, very much, Katie, for accepting my invitation for being here today. It was a lovely talk. I have so many other subjects to speak to you about, and I guess we'll have to find a way to do it, even if it's going to the courses or just sending a pigeon or something like that. So I'll see you guys well, like next month, I hope. So the hope the goal here is to have an episode of the Weird Podcast come out every month. So hopefully next month I will have another guest for you. And Katie, thank you very much once again, and see you around.
Excellent. Thank you very much.